MacCast, Saturday, February 29th, 2020. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, I normally don't start out the show this way, but I'm going to kick things off today giving you a little story, because something literally just happened as I walked into the studio. As you probably know, if you've been listening to the show for a while, I am a big fan of HomeKit. I have a few different HomeKit devices around my house, including the lights that are in my office. And I have a shortcut set up so that when I walk into the office, I announce to Siri on the HomePod in my office that I am in the office. And then she takes care of, through an automation, turning on the lights and kind of setting things up so that I can sit here and record the show. Well, tried to do that today and got a response that my devices were not responding, which I thought was a little bit odd. And so I went into the Home app, and lo and behold, all of my devices were not responding. I was getting no response from any HomeKit device whatsoever, which caused me to panic and freak out a little bit, because the thought of going through my house and having to reset up all my devices all over again is a little bit daunting. I did this a couple months ago, and while it's not super hard, it's just very time consuming. HomeKit makes it really easy, but when you have a number of devices on your HomeKit network, resetting them up is not something that you really want to do that frequently. So I immediately thought, well, maybe it's an issue with my HomePod. Tried resetting the HomePod. Nope, because that can act as kind of a bridge or a gateway. I thought, well, maybe it's the Apple TV, which is similar situation. It's kind of the bridge or gateway for HomeKit devices. So I reset that. Nope, that didn't work. I even reset my network router. That didn't seem to fix things. And then finally, I took the last step, and this is where it gets really weird and where I want to maybe get some feedback from you. I took the final step, the last-ditched effort. I thought, okay, before I completely reset the Home app and HomeKit and all that stuff and start over from scratch, what I'm going to try to do is just reset my cable modem, my network connection, which I wouldn't think would have any bearing on any of this, although I guess it does need to call out to iCloud. It's connected to your iCloud account for some of the functionality. So I ended up resetting my cable modem, and thank goodness everything came back online. But my question now becomes, why or what could happen inside my cable modem to disrupt communication? Because I wasn't having any other kind of network communication issues with the internet. So that one freaks me out a little bit. I don't really know what's going on there, but I thought I'd throw that out to the community. So a little story to kick off the show this week, where I need some troubleshooting help, maybe. And if you have thoughts and theories on that, shoot me an email, send me an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. But kind of getting back to your regularly scheduled program, looking over the Apple and Mac news this week, we have a few things to talk about. ARM-based Macs, yep, those are still potentially a thing. And we have some information this week, or some new rumors this week, about when that might happen. A little controversy over some wheels. We'll talk about that and what that means. We're not talking about Apple's car either. iPhone XR and iPhone 11, very popular last year. We'll talk about some of the numbers there. New feature in iOS, or that might be coming to iOS. And then we have some international Apple news, a couple little stories to dive into and talk about. And then we're going to talk about some cool iPad Apple Pencil tricks and tips. I have a question about cleaning up your pictures folder on your Mac, so we'll get into that a little bit. Also a question about doing secure disk images and secure documents, related to something that I've talked about on the show in the past, sort of how I do things. And then I have a couple of things of the moment this week, a couple things that I discovered this past week that I think are pretty cool that I want to share with you. So this should round out this episode of the MacCast. Should be a good one. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is Linode. Hey, look, if you need to set up a server for maybe your business, maybe a project that you're working on, maybe hosting a website, whatever it might be. If you need a server for any reason, I think you should take a look at and check out Linode, because they make it super easy to instantly deploy and manage an SSD server in their Linode cloud. You can literally get a server up and running in seconds, and you can do it with your choice of Linux distribution, resources, and a choice of up to 10 node locations. As a matter of fact, they just opened their newest data center in Mumbai, India, and that one's built using their most up-to-date hardware and next-generation network backbone, allowing you to comply with all in-country data protection requirements and take advantage of Linode's great technology and tools at the same time. And best of all, they're giving all new MacCast customers a $20 credit. And with Linode, you get so much more than just hosting. Linode has all the options and choices to enable you to build a server with the services and features you need. They can give you dedicated CPUs, they can help you build distributed applications, hosted services, websites, and continuous integration and continuous delivery environments. And best of all their servers feature native SSD storage, a 40 gigabit network, and industry-leading processors. Plus, you can pick from any of their 10 worldwide data centers. I also appreciate the fact that their pricing is simple. With no surprise fees, you pay for just what you use with hourly billing across all of their plans and add-on services. And their new cloud manager features an improved user interface, which makes managing your Linodes and upgrading your plans even easier. And it is, I have to say, one of the best management panels that I have seen with any server that I've ever worked with in the cloud. Visit linode.com/maccast to set up your first Linode and get a $20 credit. That's linode.com/maccast. And a big thank you to Linode for their support of the show. Are we going to see the first ARM-based Macs in 2021, the first Macs to feature an Apple processor? Well, that's the prediction that is being made by Ming-Chi Kuo in a recent note to his investors. He claims that we'll see the machines in the first half or sometime in the first half of 2021. Now, one thing in that note that was a little bit interesting to me, I think, was that he says, since the coronavirus outbreak, Apple's R&D has kicked into overdrive looking at production processes for a 5-nanometer chip. He says they've become, quote, more aggressive. We do expect that the A14 processors that would be in the updated iPhones and iPads this year will use 5-nanometer technology as well. And there are also hints that a new mini LED-based iPad could arrive in late 2020 or early 2021 using the 5-nanometer processor technology. Now, there are a few reasons being cited for Apple moving to ARM-based processors of their own design. The first would be to reduce reliance on Intel in their often slipping CPU release schedule, and also to increase cross-device compatibility of applications between iOS and the Mac. So are we finally moving into this era where we see convergence of Mac and iOS? I, in some ways, sort of hope not. I hope Apple sticks with this philosophy that the desktop experience and the tablet phone experience are separate experiences. But we have been seeing this more and more, especially with technologies like Catalyst bringing or making it easier for developers to bring iOS apps to the Mac desktop, and having a similar processor technology, underlying technology across all the devices would presumably help with this transition as well. As a matter of fact, as you probably know, Apple's T1 and T2 chips are already ARM-based processors that are in Macs. They're just not the core dedicated CPU. As a matter of fact, the T2 specifically offloads some critical tasks from the CPU, things like audio processing and even some video encoding. So we have seen Apple's processors doing some fairly heavy lifting in current model Macs. This would be taking it to the next level, of course, having a full Apple-designed processor based on ARM technology in a Mac. We've been talking about this coming for a long time, and it's sounding like we're getting closer and closer to this being a reality. Now, if it does turn out to be true that Apple is planning on transitioning to ARM in 2021, a big question in a lot of our minds is, when are they going to let developers in on their secret? How much leeway or how much headway are they going to give them, rather, to develop their applications for the new processor? This is something that Apple always struggles with because they don't want to tip their hand too early, but at the same time, they're going to need to have applications converted and ready, especially big critical applications, looking at you, Adobe and Microsoft, ready to go when they release. And they've struggled with this in the past. If you remember, in the transition to Intel, it was a little bit slow going. And also the transition to iOS apps, it was a little bit slow going for the bigger apps. So do we think that if Apple is going to put out new machines in 2021 based on ARM, that we'll see an announcement at this year's Worldwide Developer Conference? I would hope Apple would say something and maybe even start to have some development units available to key developers so that we can get the software ready to go. But all of that is just speculation. It's a bunch of questions that we have in our mind, but I think they would need to do that. If that is really the time schedule, early 2021, in the first half of 2021, like Ming-Chi Kuo is saying, that feels like the timeline, right? WWDC in June, that gives developers 6 to 8 to 9 months maybe to get their software ready, which still isn't a lot of time for a big CPU transition unless Apple can provide really easy tools and additions to Xcode and Swift to make that process easy. I guess more information might come at this year's Worldwide Developer Conference or maybe later, but I think the idea of Apple moving to their own processors is a really good thing for a lot of the reasons that were already stated. You also get the advantages of Apple being able to kind of control their destiny, and also ARM processors tend to be more energy efficient and run cooler, which means that Apple can do more with their designs as well. So I think it's going to be an exciting time when they transition. You know, I think if you had asked me 10 years ago if this was something that Apple would ever do or get into, I would have said no. But since the success of all Apple's A-series processors, I think they can really pull this off. They have a lot of talented engineers and chip designers within the company, as exemplified by the A-series chips, the T-series chips, and also things like the dedicated audio processors, the W1 chips and things in our AirPods. And I think Apple and their engineering team is ready to take it to the next level. Moving back to the iPad for a second and possible iPad updates this year, we've talked about a few and some that might be coming right around the corner. This week, we have a rumor via The Information that says Apple has been experimenting with an iPad smart keyboard that might come with a built-in trackpad. They believe the new design is in production now and could be released along with an updated iPad Pro this March. Some of the prototypes have featured capacitive keys rather than physical keys, which is an interesting turn of events, something that I don't know if consumers in the aftermath of the Butterfly Keyboard Mac Pro debacle would be all that thrilled with. I actually like the current smart keyboard design. I think it has a nice feel to it, and I can't imagine capacitive keys feeling like anything other than typing on a screen, which is not what you want when you're doing an add-on keyboard. So that was just something that sounds like they were prototyping and playing around with. I don't think that's going to end up being the final design. What is interesting here, of course, is the possibility of a trackpad control or trackpad style controls for your iPad. And again, another example, kind of going back to ARM, maybe coming to sort of to the Mac to integrate the experience between iOS and Mac. Here's another example or possible example of Apple thinking in that direction. And we do know that mouse and trackpad controls are currently available on iOS 13 through the accessibility features in the current versions of iOS. But that is more kind of a side feature as opposed to being a built-in core feature of the operating system. This would take it to the next level. I don't know how, again, I feel about this. I kind of like my iPad experience with the touch controls, with the smart keyboard, the way it works now. I don't think a lot of the apps, because they are touch-based, would necessarily lend themselves to being used with a pointing style device like a trackpad. But obviously, if Apple moves in this direction, developers are going to have that option and may be able to easily adapt their apps to take advantage of it. What do you think about the possibility of a trackpad with your iPad? Is it time? Have we reached that point? I think applications are getting more mature, and maybe this is a way for developers to take those apps to the next level and bring another level of control. I just worry a little bit that the experience might become a little bit fragmented, and developers are also going to have to be able to develop their apps in a way where they have to assume it's touch-based first, because that's how the iPad functions as a device. And the trackpad would be more a secondary or a possible secondary experience. Maybe there could be some additive experiences that are added with just the trackpad. But again, you're talking about sort of a core interaction experience. And on a touch device, it seems to be touch. And I don't know why you'd want to sort of pollute it or convolute it with another pointing style device. But maybe there's some applications I haven't thought of. If you have some feedback on this, shoot me an email, send me an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. Another thing related to the smart keyboard that we heard about prior to this was DigiTimes had also reported previously that Apple was making updates to the smart keyboard with possible backlit keys and scissor switches, which would be a really nice upgrade. Maybe they would do a Pro iPad smart keyboard with some of these additional features along with the trackpad. So maybe we'll even get a couple options. Who knows? Finally, in the hardware updates that we're hearing about this week, Japanese site Makatakara is claiming that the new AirTags, which are the little tile-like tags you'd be able to add to, say, things like your keys or your wallet or other physical devices to track them with your iPhone, they're saying those AirTags will be waterproof and would use magnetic wireless charging similar to the Apple Watch, which is an interesting thing. I'm not sure that it's all that necessary, though, and it would bring into question longevity of use. As you know, rechargeable sealed batteries, Apple really likes them. They like to have batteries that are non-removable in their products, so it feels very Mac-like. But for a product where you're expected to sort of use it for an extended period of time, more than just a couple years, I would imagine, you would think you would want something like a simple replaceable coin cell battery. There were reports in the last couple weeks that made it seem like AirTags might be announced soon, so I guess we might not have to wait long to find out what Apple does. But more recently, we've been hearing that the product could be something that's announced alongside the iPhone in the fall. So if Apple does make this product, and it's looking like they will, I have a question to you. Would you want removable batteries, or would you be okay with sealed batteries, making the device waterproof and just using a standard magnetic charging, wireless charging system? I think I prefer the former, but what do you think? maccast@gmail.com. Looks like Apple is once again taking a little bit of flack for its $400 add-on wheels for the new Mac Pro. This time around, it's not about having a locking feature on the wheels. This was something that was noted in a tweet by tech YouTuber Marquise Brownlee, who said, quote, "Pro tip, don't get the wheels if you keep this thing on your desk. There's no locks." And that triggered a literal Apple media fire, Apple and not just Apple, but Apple and tech website firestorm, with a ton of headlines talking about the fact that you can't lock the Mac Pro wheels, which, if you ask me, is all a little bit overblown, because guess what? The wheels are designed for having the Mac Pro on the floor so you can actually roll it around your studio. And the idea of putting a Mac on your desk with wheels just doesn't make sense. What, are you going to roll it across the desk? No, you're going to roll it across the floor. If you're going to have it on the desk, you're really going to just use the feet. The whole idea that you would do otherwise is a little bit crazy. So I think in Apple's mind, yeah, maybe you don't need wheel locks. I guess if you had a really not level studio floor, this could potentially be a problem. Maybe the Mac Pro would roll out from under your desk. I guess it could be a problem too if maybe you kick it. it might not have been a bad idea to have kind of locking wheels so you could unlock them, roll it sort of like a cart to some other area, and then lock them down. But Apple didn't go that route. I haven't had a chance to see them or even, you know, see how the wheels work. But I would imagine this is really a problem that is being called out that doesn't exist in most situations. I have a feeling, too, we'll see some pretty creative products, maybe wheel locks, wheel chocks, rather, for your Mac Pro. Hopefully those don't cost another $200 or something like that. But yeah, I guess Apple really got itself in a pickle simply by making the wheel option a $400 add-on, which is still crazy, if you ask me. I don't really understand that. I don't get it. But I guess, hey, on a potentially $50,000 computer, what's another $400? Actually, another one of the complaints about the wheel feet thing was remedied this week as well, apparently, when it was noticed in the Mac Pro technology overview by, I think, developer Steve Troughton-Smith, that Apple would make wheels available as an aftermarket add-on that customers could actually add on themselves and actually swap out the feet for wheels and vice versa. This was originally not the case. Originally, customers who wanted wheels, after choosing feet, were told that they were going to have to go to the Apple store or an Apple authorized service provider to install the part. And that still is the case right now. But what was noted in this document was that there apparently will be at some time in the future a kit to allow you to do it yourself. Now, it's not exactly clear how the kit would work, because right now the standard issue wheel set integrates directly into the stainless steel space frame, which is why I think you have to take it to an Apple store or an Apple authorized service provider to get those installed. When the new kit does become available, how much the new kit will cost and how it will all work is not clear, but it does look like something that Apple does have planned. So there may be a solution for those folks who want to have wheels and have the Mac on your desk. You're just going to have to swap feet for wheels and wheels for feet and vice versa. So that'll solve this whole rolling problem as well. But a little bit of craziness going on this week with the whole Mac Pro wheel debate again. Here's something you might not be too surprised by. People like iPhones, and also people like to get a deal. This was exemplified this week in new numbers from Omdia's smartphone model market tracker report that claim Apple shipped 46.3 million iPhone XRs in 2019, making it the most popular smartphone on the planet. That's more than double the 23.1 million units of iPhone XR that were shipped in 2018, and 9 million more than the iPhone 11 in 2019. As a matter of fact, the iPhone 11 was the second most popular smartphone globally. So Apple ranking 1 and 2 for the top 5 best-selling iPhones last year. Samsung took the 3rd, 4th, and 5th spots with the Galaxy A10, Galaxy A50, and Galaxy A20. That was followed by the iPhone 11 Pro Max in the 6th position with 17.6 million units shipped, followed by the iPhone 8 at 17.4 million shipments. The iPhone 11 Pro was the 9th most popular iPhone at 15.5 million units shipped. So as you can see, when it comes to Apple devices, people are gravitating toward the more affordable devices, at least globally. The report did note that overall in 2019, iPhone shipments were down overall about 4.6%, but Apple's still doing quite all right there at the top of the charts. And as a matter of fact, the Omdia data mirrors some recent data from Counterpoint Research that also showed that the iPhone XR and the iPhone 11 were the top-selling smartphones globally last year. Even more incredible, considering the fact that the iPhone 11 was on sale for only 4 months in 2019, so it went all the way to number 2 on the charts after not being on sale for a better part of the year. And if you look at the North American numbers, Apple comes out roses. According to Counterpoint Research, Apple actually captured the top 5 spots for smartphone popularity in the US with the iPhone XR, iPhone 11, iPhone 8, iPhone 11 Pro Max, and the iPhone XS Max all in the top 5. And overall, looking at all these numbers, I think that this really shows that there is a large demand when it comes to iPhones for more affordable, more cost-effective devices, consumers seeming to respond to that, especially in markets outside of the US and Europe. And I think overall, because we've been talking so much about the rumored iPhone 9, or what I call the iPhone 8 SE2, basically the update to the low-cost iPhone, I think that shows good signs that that is going to be a very popular model for Apple, and I would expect them to announce that and get that device out fairly soon to kind of capitalize on all of this. 9to5 Mac discovered a juicy little tidbit in the latest iOS betas that may help out when you're trying to recover your iPhone. They noticed something called OS recovery in the latest iOS 13.4 beta. Now, it's hard to be 100% sure exactly what the feature is, but the assumption is that it will be a way for you to recover your operating system on your device without needing to connect it to a Mac or a PC as you do today. In looking at the interface that they discovered, it shows a little pop-up panel, sort of like the one that you see during setup or when you connect your AirPods, that shows an icon that looks to me kind of like an AirPlay icon or a AirDrop icon. The assumption is that it would work very much like the Mac OS internet recovery that you can use in cases where something has happened to your Mac recovery volume and it can't connect to that. It will actually connect out to Apple's servers and recover over the internet. So it could possibly be like that, where it just goes out and gets a download from Apple's servers via a network, or it might be sort of like Apple's migration tool, where you could possibly connect it to another iPhone or an iPad or a, I would assume, Mac over the air or using a USB cable to do the recovery. Either way, I think that would be a welcome addition because more and more people are using their devices without maybe a desktop computer, and the ability to recover without having to connect to a Mac or PC, I think is going to become more and more critical, especially again, if we're moving to this era where iPads are more like desktops and desktops are more like iPads and vice versa, right? You're going to have more and more people that aren't relying on a Mac to connect with their iPhone. And then finally, we'll round out the news for this week with a couple little international stories, starting off with Tim Cook at Apple's recent shareholder meeting announcing that Apple would open its first retail store in India in 2021. That's because the country has been loosening its local sourcing requirements for opening retail locations, and exports of Apple devices made by Foxconn in India can now count toward meeting that requirement. They basically in India have this requirement that you need to make products in India to be able to have a retail location set up, and 30% of what you sell at your retail store has to be made within the country, and that is going to qualify in this case for the Foxconn factories basically doing assembly in India for Apple and then shipping out iPhones. A lot of the iPhones in India, as a matter of fact, are produced in the country. So reports are that Apple has leased a space in Mumbai's Maker Maxity Mall, and so that will likely be the location, or is believed to be the location, but Tim Cook has not said where it was going to be, simply that they would have a retail location in India in 2021. And then over in the EU, it looks like there is a new proposed law for smartphone makers that would require them to enable consumers to be able to quickly and easily replace their batteries, something that would affect Apple in quite probably a negative way. The law would apply to all manufacturers of smartphones within the European Union's 27 countries. Apple is already facing another proposal from the EU to establish a common charging standard for mobile devices, something that they have been fighting against. This was recently passed in Parliament, but it will be some time before the standard is established or enforced. Now, that is something they're going to have to deal with. Probably the way they'll work around it is they'll simply get rid of all ports on iPhones and go to wireless charging, something we've been hearing about for a while, because it's probably going to take a couple years for that common charging standard to get set up and ratified. Otherwise, it's probably going to be USB-C, something that we had heard Apple was considering moving to anyway, but I think it's going to be more the former than the latter. Moving to the battery thing, that is in very, very early stages right now. It's just a proposal. Actually, it was a secret leaked proposal, so it hasn't really gone anywhere, just as something that they are considering, but you can imagine the kind of impact that would have on Apple. It's not even really clear what it would mean to make it easy or convenient to replace the batteries. Is that enough to just have a connector inside that you could open the case with tools, or is it specifically meaning, hey, you need to have, like old school days, an actual consumer removable battery on the outside where you can just pop open a door, swap out a battery, and put it back in? Either way, I don't imagine that Apple is going to be particularly open to that kind of control from a government organization. And I would expect, just like the EU law for doing a charging standard, they would also fight a proposal for removable or consumer replaceable batteries as well. But we'll just have to wait and see on that one. Like I said, it's not probably coming to fruition anytime soon. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another show sponsor, and that is Zapier. You know, growing a business is hard, especially when you're wasting hours every day moving data from emails to spreadsheets to your CRM to wherever. That kind of stuff should just happen without you having to lift a finger, and there, Zapier can help. Zapier is the easiest way to automate your work. It connects to all your business software and handles work for you so you can focus on the things that matter most. No more wasting your time on tasks that you know could be automated, because that's exactly what Zapier was built to do. Just go to my special link, zapier.com/maccast, connect the apps you use most, and let Zapier take it from there. Zapier lets you instantly engage with leads, send them to CRM or spreadsheet, then notify your team so that they can act fast on every opportunity. And that's really just scratching the surface. Zapier supports more than 1,500 business applications, so the possibilities are virtually endless. And best of all, it's easy to build the exact solution you need in minutes, all without writing code or asking a developer for help. Join the 4.5 million people who are saving an average of 40 hours per month using Zapier. Right now, through the end of the month, try Zapier free by going to our special link, zapier.com/maccast. That's zapier.com/maccast for your free 14-day trial, zapier.com/maccast. And a big thank you to Zapier for their support of the show. I thought we'd kick things off here with a couple little quick tips on using the Apple Pencil with the iPad. And this first one is a cool quick tip for taking screenshots on the iPad with the Apple Pencil. And I knew about this tip, but I've never really used it. And I was reminded about this feature by a Mac Observer article from Charlotte Henry. I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to check it out. But basically, you take your Apple Pencil on your iPad and you swipe up from the bottom left-hand corner of the screen, and boom, it instantly takes a screenshot, all without having to do the, you know, button press with the sleep-wake button and the volume button. I can honestly never remember which one is the right one. I always forget that. So this is a much better way for me to be able to take a screenshot. And best of all, when you do it that way, it jumps right into markup mode. So if you want to annotate that screenshot, add in additional information, put in an arrow, add a box around something, add some text to it, save it, share it. You can do it all from right there with just one simple flick gesture of your Apple Pencil up from the lower left corner. It is pretty cool and probably something now I will start using a little bit more. Another little tip that I often forget about is there's also a very quick way to get in and take a note with your Apple Pencil. If you just tap with the Apple Pencil from the lock screen, it will open up a new note. And this is by default. There's also a setting. You can actually go into the settings and disable this. So if it's not working for you, go into your settings, go into Apple Pencil, and make sure that you have this turned on so that you can access notes from the lock screen. But once you do that, just a simple tap, and it will, boom, open up the Notes app. Another cool tool that's available in the Notes app that I don't use that frequently but is super, super handy is the ruler tool. So in the little panel that comes up, there is a ruler, and it can help you draw straight lines, which is something that's not too easy to do in the Notes app. Some third-party apps have some great little tricks for drawing straight lines. I think like Linea, if you use that application, when you draw a line, if you just hold at the end of the line, it will straighten it out for you, and you can even use that for geometric shapes. But in the Notes app, the ruler is a handy little tool. You can bring it up, it brings it up on screen, and you can just draw along the edge of the ruler, and you'll get a nice straight line. You can also use two fingers to rotate the ruler, and as you rotate, it'll actually show you the degrees, so you can actually do mathematical lines at specific angles, and you know they will be accurate to your page. And also, I noticed it does show units as you draw, although I couldn't quite figure out what the units were. I think they're actually pixels, so you can draw a line of a certain number of pixels in length. If I don't have that right, I tried to look up on Apple's support website. It doesn't really note it. Couldn't find any information. I think it's pixels. Maybe it's centimeters. I don't really know. If you happen to know, shoot me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. But like I said, just a couple quick tips for using the Apple Pencil with your iPad. I'm sure there's some other great tips out there. If you have one of them, send in an audio comment. Let us know about it, maccast@gmail.com. Next up, I want to talk about cleaning up the pictures folder, because actually Jim wrote in, sent me an email, and he's like a lot of us, he has a ton of digital photos, and they sort of, on the Mac, seem to collect themselves up in the pictures folder inside your home folder, whether that be, as Jim pointed out, just a bunch of JPEG files that are loose in the folder, maybe some Photoshop files that are laying around that you worked on, old iPhoto libraries, maybe you have the new Photos library in the Photos app, and he, in his case, even has some Aperture libraries that are lying around, and he wanted to know, what's your advice for cleaning all of that stuff up? How do I go about it? Specifically, he asked, if I dumped all my photos onto a new external hard drive, just like a spinning USB 3 hard drive, can I form one large library under the new Photos app? And if I do that, how do I clean up and delete all the potential duplicates? And also, will I have a 250 gigabyte library? Is that going to be too much to manage in a single photo library? Is it going to bog things down? Is it going to be slow? If that's the case, should I consider an SSD external drive versus maybe a spinning hard drive? A lot of really great questions, Jim, and I'm going to try to help you out. I'm certainly not an expert when it comes to this. If you saw my photo library, it has a lot of duplicates in it, and I'll mention that here in a second. But in just thinking about this, personally, I think what I would do is say, yeah, I think you could get everything merged into a single photo library. I don't think 250 gigabytes is too much or too big. We have some pretty big photo libraries out there, and the current version of the application seems to be able to handle that at least fairly well. I do think before you start any of this, start messing with any of these libraries and try to merge them together, try to deduplicate them, I would make 100% sure, my very first bit of advice, and you probably know what I'm going to say, is make sure that you have backups of everything. I would get some external drives. I would take all those disparate libraries and I would put them onto some form of backup, probably two forms of backup, and make sure you have them there just in case anything goes south. But I do think this idea of getting an external hard drive and maybe moving all of the libraries onto that or consolidating the libraries there is a good one. You know, I think you have to know up front too that doing this process, no matter how you do it, is probably going to be pretty manual. It's going to involve quite a few steps. It's going to be a little bit painful, but I think the reward in the end is that you have a single clean image library, which I think is what you're going for. So I think it's a good exercise, but it's certainly not going to be a speedy process. But definitely get a large external hard drive. If you can afford an SSD, I think that would give you the best performance, but I do think you could get away with just using a traditional hard drive, spinning hard drive as well. You might just have to be a little bit more patient with your large library as you're going through it. And certainly, I would say there's nothing wrong with splitting up the library if you have a logical way to do that into smaller chunks. It really depends on what you're trying to do. I prefer to have just one big library that I can go through. It's easy and convenient for me. I do have a lot of photos and it hasn't been a problem, but I would imagine at a certain point there are libraries that may get just too unwieldy, and maybe you want to break it down by number of years, and you can have multiple photo libraries and you can switch between them. A lot of people do that. There are some tools to help you manage that, and I'll mention one of those here in a second as well. But get that external drive. That's the place to start. And then I think you really have two different approaches or possible ways that you could go about this. And it really depends on what you're trying to accomplish, because I think each method has its advantages and disadvantages. One thing you could do is you could try taking all of those old libraries and exporting the originals from those libraries. So your Aperture library, your photo library, and maybe your iPhoto libraries if you still have those lying around. Basically, export all of the images into a single location, probably that external hard drive, run some sort of deduplication, clean up on all of the original images, and then re-import them back into a brand new clean photo library. So you could start with a fresh photo library, bring all of your originals back in from all their various locations, and kind of get them all consolidated that way. Of course, the downside here is you're starting from scratch, right? So if you had any edits in any of those old libraries, if you had a lot of metadata that you had applied to that stuff, if you had organization, maybe in terms of albums and things that you had built out, a lot of that is going to get lost in this process, right? So this is really, hey, I just have a bunch of disparate stuff. I just want the originals. I don't care about my edits. I don't care about any of that other data or organization. I just want a single clean library that doesn't have duplicates in it. That might be a methodology that you take. I think the other option is probably the more common one, and that is start with an existing library, probably your photos library, because that's ultimately where you're going to get everything into. So take your existing photos library, try and clean it up as much as you can there, and then take those Aperture libraries, those iPhoto libraries, any other images, and import everything into that single library. If you need help with how to do that, Apple's support website has some instructions on doing this. You can just search for, you know, import Aperture library to photos or import iPhoto library to photos, and there's some great instructions there. And then once it's in the library, then you can proceed to do cleanup and organization as well. There are some tools that can help out with this too, to help you deduplicate and remove any duplicates from your library. Now, I will tell you, personally, I'm always a little bit leery about deduplicating libraries. It makes me nervous just as a person who values his photos that are in his photo library. But there are some great tools out there that can help you out. One is Gemini 2 from MacPaw, and I'll have links to these in the show notes at maccast.com. And the other one is Power Photos from Fat Cat Software. So Power Photos also has some features to allow you to kind of merge libraries, to separate libraries, to deduplicate libraries. So specifically for photos from Apple Photos application libraries. And so it can be helpful there. The Gemini 2 software, it does work on the photos library, but it also has the ability to just compare folders, to deduplicate files on your system. It can also work with your iTunes library. So both very powerful tools, but a little bit different in how you would work with them. But I think the process is ultimately the same, right? You're trying to get all your photos into one location, whether that be just a folder with all the originals in it, and then kind of clean up and deduplicate from there, or get all of the libraries merged into a single photos library and do your cleanup on that side of things. I have to finish this up by saying, honestly, for me, I've chosen to just live with my photos library having a certain number of duplicate files. I think in some cases I have some photos that are duplicated 2, 3, maybe even 4 times. And I think for some people that would drive them absolutely nuts. I see them. It does bother me. I wish I could clean them up, but I've run these deduplication programs. And while they're very good at showing you kind of the comparisons, and they'll even do byte for byte comparisons to make sure that, yes, these are actually duplicates, I always worry in the back of my mind that I'm going to delete the wrong version. Like, this one is, you know, a thumbnail version of that one or something like that. And these programs are very good at pointing out that that is really not the case. But still in the back of my mind, it's almost like conspiracy theory. I think I'm going to mess up my library. And I just realized that, you know, the library performs fine. I can find the photos that I want. Yes, sometimes I'd go to find a photo and there's 4 versions of the same photo. But I'd rather have 4 versions of the same one than risk possibly deleting the one that I really wanted to keep. But that's just me. I know a lot of other people use these tools and use them very successfully, but I am going to point that out because I think for some of us, we're happy to just live with a little bit of clutter if it makes us feel a little bit more secure. But those are kind of my tips. I'm sure there's many in the community, many folks in the community. You probably have some other great tips for organizing, cleaning up photo libraries, merging, deduplicating. I would love to hear those. I'd love to share those with the community. And Jim, if you can send those along, especially in the form of an audio comment, I'd appreciate it. maccast@gmail.com. Another thing I was asked about this week was something that I bring up on the show from time to time, especially around this time of year, because I'm going to be getting ready to do my taxes. And as you might imagine, tax documents, tax forms have a lot of secure personal information that you probably don't want getting out if your Mac were to be lost or stolen or compromised. And I do a couple of things to protect my data, specifically on my Macs. I do run File Vault 2, which is great whole disk encryption, very easy to enable on the Mac. We've talked about that before. But with certain kinds of documents, specifically tax documents and any documents that contain personal information or data, whether they be PDFs or Excel files or whatever it might be, I take another measure to protect those documents, and I create an encrypted disk image. And I do that through the disk utility. And then when I want to work with those documents, I basically mount that disk image, I open it up, I work with the documents that are contained in there, and then when I'm done, I eject that disk image, and it is secured and protected. And a disk image is really just like a document that lives on your hard drive, albeit a special one. It's really a container, right? It's a disk image. But you work with it pretty much like a file when it's closed, and then all you do is double click on it, it opens up, it mounts in the Finder like a disk, and then you can work in it. And it was Chelsea who was asking me about all of this. She said, do you keep these in, you know, these documents in an encrypted folder or a disk image? What are the main differences? And the answer is the main difference is that you can use disk utility to encrypt a folder. But what it essentially does is it takes that folder and turns it into an encrypted disk image. So we're kind of talking about the same thing. It behaves like a folder, or more specifically, it behaves like a virtual external hard drive or a volume, and it mounts on your desktop. So you'll not see it like a folder. You actually see it like a disk. And then inside that, you can have files and folders and all those things, and those can be encrypted. And specifically, I use an encrypted sparse image bundle. And like I said, disk utility allows you to create these things. The benefits of using a what's called a sparse bundle, because you can create a bunch of different kinds of disk image. There's a bunch of disk image formats. The sparse bundle is nice because when you set it up, you set it up for a specific size, say 100 gigabytes. So ultimately that thing can use 100 gigabytes of storage. But that image itself will only be as large as the data it contains. And it's important to note with disk images, typically if you just create a standard disk image, and it's 100 gigabytes in size, not a sparse one, it will use up 100 gigabytes of space, whether you have one file in it or you have, you know, 10,000 files in it. It doesn't really matter what's stored in it. It's going to take up that amount of space even when it's not, you know, mounted. So it kind of works a little bit differently. With the sparse bundle, it's going to be able to expand and grow up to that size. You can't expand it or make it bigger, at least I don't think with Disk Utility. There might be some other tools that allow you to make it larger, but you kind of have to decide ultimately how much stuff you're going to be storing in there. Of course, you could always just create another sparse bundle and just do things that way. And I think some people even do that. Like, I could create a sparse bundle just for my tax files. I could create a sparse bundle just for other personal files that I want to protect. Doesn't really matter. And it's pretty straightforward. You just open up Disk Utility. You under the file menu, you choose to create a new blank image. You'll want to format it as APFS or macOS extended, depending upon, you know, the file system that you prefer. You'll enter the size of the disk, the image that you want to create. You'll choose the sparse bundle disk image format. And then this is the important part. You'll choose encryption level. And I think you can do 128-bit or 256-bit. I think Apple recommends 128, but if you want much more secure, you can go 256. And when you select that option, it will ask you to create a password to protect that encrypted bundle. And of course, you want to create a good, secure password, store that in your password manager. But a nice thing that Mac OS will do too, or the Disk Utility will do, is it will ask you if you want to save that to your keychain. I would advise saving that to your Mac's keychain. That way, when you go to mount the image, it can get that login information or that password from your keychain. You won't have to enter it every time, and it makes it more convenient. Just recognize that that means that if your Mac is unlocked and opened, and someone were to access your machine, then they would potentially be able to open up that encrypted disk image as well. But as long as you're, you know, practicing good safe procedures, making sure you lock down your Mac when you walk away, have it locked when it goes to sleep, you should be protected just fine. So you create the disk image, you save it, and then, like I said, you just double click on it and you mount it. And so to answer your question, you know, where do I store that image? You know, do I sync it up to iCloud? Do I sync it to my backups? I absolutely do, because I store that encrypted disk image in my documents folder, or that disk image in my documents folder. That's where it lives. So I can literally go into documents. I think I call it secure documents. I can double click on it. It will mount on my desktop. Like I said, I work with it that way. And then when I close it out, it just lives in my documents folder. And because I use iCloud Drive and iCloud document folder syncing, it gets synced to my iCloud. But the file is what gets synced, that sparse image, and it's encrypted, and only I have the password. And so all of that gets backed up. So that image is still secure when it's in the cloud. And the same thing goes for when it's on my Time Machine Drive, in a Time Machine backup, or my Carbon Copy Cloner backup, or my Backblaze backups. It is really great. And another thing that I do is I use Paperless, which is a great application from Mariner Software, for scanning in all of my bills and my documents, basically having all of my files in a paperless format. And I chose, when I created the library for paperless, that that was on that encrypted disk image as well. So before I'm able to launch the paperless application on my Mac, I always have to make sure I mount that sparse image bundle, because that's where the library for that lives. So I just launch the bundle first, or mount the bundle first, and then use the program. And that way I know all of my documents that go in there that contain account numbers, bank account information, all of that stuff, all of those PDFs and things that are generated, those are safe and secure inside my encrypted disk image as well. So that's how I use it. That's what I do. The other question that Chelsea had, that Chelsea, I really don't have a great answer for you, is she asks, is there a way to set a folder in iCloud so that anything that I put into it would automatically get downloaded to an iOS device? And of course, you know, if you're using iCloud Drive, it will always sync anything that you put on your Mac into an iCloud Drive folder up to iCloud, and you would be able to access that on an iOS device, say inside the Files app. But as far as I know, it doesn't get downloaded automatically. You would have to go into the Files app on iOS when you're connected to the internet and manually download that document. And then once it's downloaded, it will live there until you run out of space on your iOS device. And then if it hasn't been accessed in a while, it will do some auto cleanup and it might remove that from your local device to gain back space. And you'd have to manually re-download it again. But as far as I know, there's no way to tell a iCloud Drive folder on your iOS device to automatically sync and always automatically download files. I think that actually would be a nice feature for a future version where I can say, okay, just this one folder, I want anything that I put in here to always be synced, sort of more like how Dropbox worked between Macs. But at this time, I don't think there's a way to do that. If there is, maybe someone in the community will let us know. But some great questions, Chelsea, and hopefully that helps demystify for you how I use encrypted disk images to kind of protect my documents and stuff. All right, last couple things for this week. I have a couple of really cool things of the moment, some stuff that I ran across this week, I started playing around with and using. I want to start off with a new application for Mac and iOS from the folks at Icon Factory called Tot, T-O-T. It's a new little note application that is really simple, and I think it's almost more like a stickies application. It basically gives you 7 colored notes, and that's it, just 7 text notes that you can put text information into. It is super basic, and that's actually the point behind this thing. For me, like I said, it feels like a natural replacement for the stickies app, which actually, as I was prepping the show, I realized still exists. It's still in macOS Catalina stickies. You probably already knew this because you might be using it, but I haven't used stickies in years. And stickies were always a convenient place where you could stick little bits of information, little bits of text, come back and grab them back later. They're probably not going to live there forever. They're probably sort of transient kind of information, right? Things that you would put on a sticky note. And I see myself using the Tot application very much like this, although there is some power behind it because there's some scriptability, there's some things that you can do with it. So, you know, on the surface, I think it looks really minimalistic, and I think that's where its power is. But I have a feeling people are going to find some really creative ways of using this. And what's nice is you have a lot of options for how you want to use it. You can use it like a standalone app. You can also add it to the menu bar, which is what I've chosen to do. You can set up a hotkey to activate it. It has some really nice hotkeys for jumping between notes, so you can kind of control the whole thing from the keyboard. You can copy and paste into your different notes very quickly and easily. And it does have very minimal formatting. I was excited because it supports Markdown, but it's not the full Markdown specification. As a matter of fact, I think the only 2 or 3 bits of Markdown that it supports are things like bold, italic, and I think ordered and unordered lists, and that is it. So it doesn't do headings. It doesn't do some of the other features. It does do links and rich text format kinds of stuff. But again, it's very minimal and basic, and it's meant to be that way. And best of all, on the Mac, it is completely free. You can get it from the Mac App Store. It's called Tot. If you want to sync everything over to your iOS devices, there is an iOS companion app, and that is $19.99 US. And I just went ahead and bought the app on iOS mainly to support the developers, because I think this is a great little application. $20 feels a little bit pricey for it, but I think the point is that you're getting this great Mac application, you're getting this great iOS application, and combined for $20, it's actually a really good deal for those folks who think they can use it. So I think it's a really neat application. I'm going to be using it. I just got into it, though. It just came out this week, so I haven't had a chance to use it too much. As I figure out more uses for it and hear about more tips and tricks, I'll try to bring those to you here on the MacCast. And if you've started using it, I'd love to hear what you're doing with it as well. So the first thing of the moment is Tot, T-O-T, from Icon Factory. Check it out. And again, the links will be in the show notes at maccast.com. The second one is a fun one, and this is for those of you who have an Apple Arcade subscription or who are maybe considering trying out Apple Arcade, because Hipster Whale, the folks who made Crossy Road, just came out with a new Crossy Road application or Crossy Road game called Crossy Road Castle exclusively on Apple Arcade. And I had a bunch of fun playing this weekend on my Apple TV with a controller. It is a side-scrolling platformer style game. It's actually kind of a mashup between a side-scroller and an endless runner. Basically, the object of the game is to get your character as high up in a castle as possible. So you kind of leap and jump over obstacles and around enemies and things like that. And you're trying to get up higher and higher in this castle. And the higher you get, the more rewards you get and the more prestige you get and the more high points you get. And it is really, really fun. It uses the same kind of Crossy Road characters. It has the same kind of reward system as Crossy Road with the little gumball machine, so you can get additional characters, unlock additional characters. You can unlock accessories in the form of hats that you can put on your characters. And what I liked about it, too, is it's multiplayer. You can play up to four players at a time. You can play over Wi-Fi, or you can all be just connected to your Apple TV. And it is a lot of fun. It actually makes it a little bit easier with multiplayers because you all share basically three lives, and you have opportunities to purchase additional lives through your rewards. So there's a lot of really nice elements to it. And in addition to being kind of a side-scrolling endless runner, there's also some puzzle elements to try to figure out how to get to certain areas, how to gain additional power-ups and additional rewards. It is just a really cool, fun game. And of course, because it's on Apple Arcade, you can play it on Mac, you can play it on Apple TV, you can play it on iOS. Doesn't matter, it goes across all your platforms, and it's all included for your $5 a month Apple Arcade subscription. So I continue to be a big fan of Apple Arcade. I am really loving it. It's nice that when a new game comes out, I can just jump in and enjoy it. And I think this is a really great and fun one. So check this out too, Crossy Road Castle on Apple Arcade. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of TextExpander and PF Pen, also TextExpander for iPhone and iPad, and PF Pen for iOS. You can find more information and details on all of their great software by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CashFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check me out on Instagram, MacCast, on there as well. With that, that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.